Melinda hated driving at night. She did her best to avoid it. Short trips to the store if she realized she ran out of tampons or had nothing for dinner after getting home. That sort of thing happened now and then. But she did her best not to go out after dark unless someone was coming to pick her up. So naturally, she found herself on the longest drive of her life tonight, with no moon, few stars, swirling clouds above her, and acres of forest on either side. As so many unpleasant things in her life, this was her father's fault. She hadn't seen or spoken to the bastard in 15 years, but after falling asleep tonight... No, that was wrong. It would be yesterday by this time. Out of the blue, her phone rang and his voice was on the other end. "I need you, Mallie. Please come now." He said just that, and then the line went dead. His old ass was probably drunk, but he'd never called her before, not since she was a child, and he was still trying to convince her mother to take him back. It felt like she'd been dreaming, waking up to hear his voice again after all these years. It sounded like he was crying. His voice sounded just the same as the last time she'd heard it. As though in a dream, she'd risen, dressed, and gotten into the car. She was well out of town and halfway to his old place before realizing that she had no way of knowing if he even still lived there. She received updates from her mother from time to time over the years about where he was. The last time she heard from her mother was about 7 years ago. Had he ever stayed in one place that long? Not to her recollection, but... She'd been 7 when her mother finally had enough and showed him the door. Prior to that, a move had come every few months. The house they'd been living in was the longest stay in one place, a full 16 months. Turned into 2 years after that, and then the next house had been the one she left when she moved out on her own. In all that time, she heard from him sporadically at best, and had finally decided it was best to simply forget about him. Until tonight. She'd found out after a 2-hour drive that she had been right to wonder if he was still in the same place. His last known address was a sketchy apartment in a low-income area of the town that she'd grown up in. Had he been number 24 or 42? Maybe it was 14. It definitely had a 4. It didn't matter. His name wasn't on any of the buzzers. Bastard. Her drunk of a father called her at night, all but demanding she come for him for reasons he didn't even feel were important enough to tell her over the phone, and then just expected that she would know where he lived now. In a flurry of rage, she turned and marched back to her car, slamming the door and staring off into the direction she came. She was so angry, she didn't even look where she was going. And now she'd missed her turnoff. Next thing she knew, she was on this lonely stretch of road. Cars were sparse, but she took some comfort in the fact that she'd pass one every half hour or so. Her dashboard clock now read 2:27 a.m. She'd been driving for more than 5 hours since leaving her house. At night. Every 5 minutes or so, she'd check her cell phone. Ever since realizing she was lost, she'd checked her phone and found no bars at all. She even stopped at a closed gas station, of course, just sure there should be some service around there somewhere, but there was nothing. "Take stock of your life, Mellie," she thought. "You're over 30, you hate your job, and you and your mother don't really get along. You haven't seen or spoken to your father in just under half your life. You have no time for your friends or relationship thanks to the aforementioned job that you hate. And now here you are, trapped on a road you've never been on before at night, and you can't even so much as call AMA, let alone check Google Maps. Smart lady you are." She briefly considered stopping and flagging down the next car that passed. She quickly realized the futility of that plan. Any car on this road would also have no service, so there was nothing for it. She'd have to drive until she saw a house. She'd feel bad for waking someone up, but there was no choice. She needed to find her way back to the main highway. But so far, all that she could see on either side was trees. Mile after mile of trees. No lights shining through the boughs. No sign that anyone had ever been here before, except that there was a road and people were obviously still driving on it. There weren't even any road signs other than the mile markers. Had she really found the middle of nowhere? She was just in the middle of this thought when her headlights illuminated something just up the road, a square wooden sign, obviously made by someone other than the government. This wasn't a gas food lodging sign, or a mile marker, or a distance to sign. They looked like the kind of signs advertising a private business that was nearby. She slowed down to read it. Granny Royce's Roadhouse. Come stay the night at Granny's. She'll take good care of you. Room, board, low prices. Next exit. Her heart sped up. She certainly wasn't interested in spending a night at Granny Royce's, but every business had a phone. At the very least, she'd have a map or know the way back to the highway. She decided she'd stop there. And she almost missed the turn. Granny Royce's Roadhouse was buried at the back of a long dirt driveway, secluded amid the trees. She was almost past the little dirt road that led back to it before realizing it was there. She skidded to a stop and turned in. The little house lay ahead. It was two stories, looked to have about 8 to 10 rooms. Big for a home, but small for anything announcing room and board. She got closer and looked for a vacancy sign. Nothing. It wasn't the sign that wasn't lit. There was no sign. The porch light was on, and the front of the building was illuminated by that light and by her headlights. No signs of any kind. She almost wondered if she'd gotten the wrong place, and she was certain that she'd see no other exits between this house and the sign announcing it. She paused in the driveway and took out her cell again. Still, no service. She did a quick search for any available wireless signals, and to her complete lack of surprise, there were none. Not even any secured. There's no one here but me, she thought. At this point, she wouldn't be surprised to find the house empty as well, but the light was on and this was supposed to be a roadhouse. Someone would be manning the front desk. She got out of the car and headed for the front porch. As she turned around to make sure the lights flashed when she hit the lock button on her fob, she thought she could see a flash of movement in the trees. Something human-shaped. She stopped and looked again. Nothing. She decided that she'd imagined it. At the front door, she hesitated. If it really was a roadhouse, then she should be able to just go in, but what if she got the wrong house? If she tried the door and just walked in, she could find herself arrested out here in buttfuck nowhere. Cautiously, she tried the knob. It turned. She pressed gently on the door, and it opened. Relief flooded through her when she saw that she was in a small but tastefully decorated foyer that had obviously been repurposed as an admissions area. A quaint desk with an honest-to-God guestbook had been placed in the far right corner, and some chairs had been set out along with magazines on the table. She read the titles briefly. Mademoiselle, Blue Book, The New Country Life, and Arts and Architecture, before turning her attention to the little desk. There wasn't a computer. That was a cute touch. It was like the house was from a past era. Perhaps old Granny Royce really didn't like modern technology. There was, however, a little bell. Just like there would have been in 1929. It wasn't even the round silver kind you slapped to ring. It was a little porcelain hand bell. This place was starting to out-cute her. Please let her have a phone, and please let it use the number plan, not 50s exchanges. She picked up the bell and gave it a little shake. For a while, nothing happened. Then she saw a light come on in the back room, and the shadow of an old woman sprang up on the wall. The shadow moved toward her, and within a few seconds she saw its owner, Granny Royce, who perhaps looked like every grandmother in every storybook ever.
"Well, goodness me," she said. "My lands. Good morning, dearie. Pardon my tardiness, it's been a while since we got a guest at this hour. Can I take your name, honey?"
Granny Royce was smallish, her gray hair tied in a neat bun behind her head. A dress that would have looked like it belonged to a senior citizen in the 20s, and a faded pink sweater. Melinda thought that she looked just like she would have wanted her own grandmother to look like, but her mother's mother had died when she was young, and she'd never met her father's mother. It almost hurt to deny this sweet little woman her business, but nevertheless, she had to be home. Actually, I'm sorry, she began. The fact is, I'm lost. Not even sure where I am in the direction of...
Oh, you poor thing, said Granny Royce. You just sit down, let me fix you some tea or something. You must be cold.
Really, thank you, but I'm okay, Melinda said gently. I just need to use the phone if I could, or if you could give me a map, even that would be lovely. I really only live a couple hours from here. She trailed off, not knowing if she was even right about that. She easily could have driven those 5+ hours in the wrong direction entirely.
Oh, dear, said the little woman sadly. I'm sorry, honey, but the phone lines are down. As for a map, I used to have one. If I look, I still might, but it's probably quite out of date by now. Highway moved since then, I know that much.
Melinda's heart sank. How could her luck get any worse? No phone, cell, or landline, and no map. What could she do? She had to get back home. She was expected back to work at 8 a.m. tomorrow. And why were the phone lines down? The weather was coldish, but it was clear. Were they fixing a line nearby? She told Granny Royce the name of her town, but Granny only said,
Believe it or not, I've never heard of that town. What'd you say the name was?
She told her again.
No, doesn't ring a bell, I'm sorry. But I couldn't say which direction it's in. Why don't you stay the night, sweetie? I'll give you a discount for your trouble.
Thank you, that's very kind, but I have to work tomorrow and I need to get home. I'm not even sure why I'm out tonight. The only reason I had doesn't even matter anymore.
Honey, I won't advise to drive back that far tonight,
Granny Royce said.
Why, it's almost 3 a.m. You've had any sleep. Maybe any lines will be up in the morning. You can call your work and let them know you'll be late.
That won't work either, she replied. I'm the opener. Nobody will be there. No, I'm sorry. I really gotta leave. I'll head in the other direction until I find the road I was on. At that, Granny Royce's expression, already one of kind concern, seemed to shift somewhat to one of fear. She paused, looking at Melinda as though she wanted to say something else to keep her inside. Finally, she reluctantly said,
All right, honey, if you're sure. Just you be careful now. Don't speak to nobody until you're back on the road.
That last warning seemed a little silly. After all, what was Melinda, a little girl? She thanked Granny Royce for her kindness and headed back to the car. About halfway to the car, she remembered thinking she saw something moving in the trees. Her eyes scanned both sides of the secluded little cleared area she was in, looking for anything that appeared to be moving on its own, rather than being blown by the slight wind. And she saw nothing. Satisfied, she headed for her car. All 4 tires were flat. God damn it. She leaned down and saw long slash marks on each tire. Someone in this little slice of Green Acres had slashed her tires in the time it took her to find out that she had no way of contacting anyone tonight. Kids from a local farmhouse. Gotta be, she thought grimly. Nothing else to do, so you may as well go out at night and slash tires. She stopped and let the reality sink in. She wasn't going anywhere tonight. She had no choice now. She had to stay the night there until morning, when hopefully the phone lines would be up and she could call someone from work to ask them to go in for her and then AMA to get her tires dealt with. She sighed and walked back into the house. She could hear Granny Royce as she was walking back to her room. She'd already turned off the lights. Resigned to her fate, Melinda rang the little bell again.
Is that you, miss?
She heard Granny Royce call.
Yeah, it's me,
she answered.
Sorry to be a bother.
My name's Melinda Orton. Sorry, I never mentioned that before. I guess I'll take a room for the night if the offer's still good.
Oh, of course it is, dearie,
said Granny Royce, re-entering the room and turning the lights back on.
Melinda? Oh, that's such a pretty name, honey. Well, let's get you situated. Put
put your name and arrival time in the book there, and I'll get you a key. All the boarding rooms are on the second floor, and there's only a couple left. There are others here? This was surprising. Not a single car had been in the front lawn when she pulled in. Oh yes, Miss Melinda. Granny was puttering around in the adjacent room. Miss Norris, young Calvin, and a few of us here. She came back out with the key in her hand. Just out of curiosity, what made you change your mind? She seemed to brighten as she asked the question, as though relieved that Melinda would stay after all. It's probably just local kids getting their kicks in, but I found my tires slashed. Granny stopped suddenly, her face twisted with concern and worry. Then she resumed as though nothing was wrong. Nothing to be done for it, I suppose, she said with an air of sadness. Well, not until morning at any rate, said Melinda. And hopefully the lines will be up. Oh, said Granny Rose distractedly. Yes, hopefully. She led Melinda up the darkened staircase into an empty, quiet hall. Perhaps not so quiet. From one end of the hall came the muffled sound of someone crying. Whoever it was, they were crying softly, not with anger or petulance or fear, but with a deep sadness. It sounded as if crying was something this person was used to, but they were still unable to stop. Who's that? She asked, pointing in the direction of the crying.
I'll pay that no mind, honey, said Granny. That's just Mr. Norris. He's been like that for a while. Older man, you understand. Not all there.
She tapped her temple. I understand, Melinda replied, but wondered privately how an old, out-of-touch man would wind up at a roadhouse. Has he been here long?
A while, I'd say, answered Granny. Don't really recall how long, exactly.
How does he pay for room and board? I guess he doesn't drive, she said to the old woman. Actually, it doesn't look like anyone else here has a car. Granny started at this, looking up with an almost guilty expression.
Oh, well, she said. That kind of thing is the business of the guest. I don't ask so much about things.
She turned the key in the lock in the room and led Melinda to the opened door. Turning on the light, she showed Melinda the quaint little room. Melinda thought it looked like stepping into the past. She could swear this room would have looked modern in the early 50s at the earliest. Come to think of it, so could the rest of this place, she thought. No wireless service, no computer, that old bell, and those magazines, they looked new, but... That thought was cut off as Granny put the key in the nightstand and started with instructions. Now the bathroom's down the hallway there. You'll be sharing it with the whole floor, so please bear in mind that if you have to go. There's a shower scheduled on the door as well. First come, first serve. Just add your name to the first available line, and that's the order the showers are in. I wouldn't worry about that if I were you, though. I'm sure you'll be the first in line. I get up at 6 a.m. sharp every morning and start breakfast, but you come on down whenever you're ready and I'll whip something up for you. Oh, and one last thing, my dear. I would strongly advise you not to leave the house until the sun is up. You just never know what could happen out there in the dark. Of course, she replied. I'd never go out there in the dark if I didn't have to. She stopped that train of thought right out the gate. After a few moments, she was alone. Alone without anything to wear to bed and nothing to shower with, brush her teeth or hair with in the morning. She sat on the bed and looked out the window, which faced front. Her car still sat where she'd left it, the only thing for miles that seemed like part of her world. And an expensive, overlarge paperweight until I can get a hold of someone, she thought bitterly. Despite the hominess of the room, she felt an unwillingness to rise and shut off the light. Somehow the thought of going to sleep in this backward little room seemed unthinkable. So instead, she continued to sit and stare out the window. A figure in black detached itself from the shadows of the trees and made its way to her car. The hell? She jumped and ran at the window. The figure was tall and seemed to be wearing a cloak made of night. She saw as its arm extended. Its hand was a long, jagged dagger. It dragged the dagger across the side of her car, leaving a long gash mark in the painted metal.
Hey!
She shouted. The figure kept dragging the dagger. She reached for the window to open it, and it wouldn't budge. She looked for a lock, but couldn't see one.
Hey!
She yelled again. This time, the figure raised its head, and she could see the glint of two eyes under the hood. The figure raised the dagger slowly, determinedly, and pointed straight at her face. She leapt from the window and ran for the door. A noise on the other side stopped her. Footsteps, dragging, shambling footsteps. And crying. The sound of a person for whom deep, longing sadness is a way of life. Mr. Norris. She waited. Somehow, she just felt that she should let the old man pass before she opened the door. Before he got very far, however, she heard other footsteps, these much quicker and lighter, run up the stairs and stop near the door of her room.
Stop it, hissed Granny's voice. Go back to your room right now. You know better. She can't see you yet. Hopefully she won't see you at all. Now you go back in there. You've got no business being out at this hour anyway.
What on earth? How could that sweet old woman talk to another human being that way, let alone an old man with a foggy mind? She almost opened the door right then, but somehow her hand stopped and waited until the shuffling, crying man had made his way back down the hallway. She heard his door open. She opened her own door just in time to see his foot, shod in a well-worn house shoe, slide into his room. The door closed softly after him. That poor man, she thought. But now she was determined to find out what was going on. The punk outside in the Halloween costume, slashing up her car, followed by Granny yelling at an old man, made her begin to understand that not all was well here. She went back down to the front desk area, which was completely unlit except for the moonlight and the porch light coming through the window. There was, however, a light on near the back room that Granny Royce had emerged from before. Melinda paused to take a look outside the front window. The maniac with the dagger was nowhere to be seen for the moment, but she was now determined that it was he that she'd seen moving through the trees. He could have killed me. She strode in the direction of the light, seeing that it was the lights of the kitchen. She kept going, expecting to find Granny Rose still puttering about with whatever an old innkeeper did with herself during the early hours of the morning. Instead, she found Granny, sitting with a young man of about 20. He had dark hair and a scruff of stubble, and was wearing dark brown corduroy shirt and khakis, along with a pork pie hat. It looked like he was ready to go sell newspapers on a street corner in the 30s. He was quietly sipping tea while Granny was admonishing him from the other end of the table.
That was a horrible thing to say, she said. When I was your age, young men minded their manners.
That's a laugh, talking about my age, muttered the young man with a sneer.
And just how old are you? Do you even remember? Calvin Davidson, you're in trouble, young man,
she hissed back. Neither had noticed Melinda yet.
One of these days you're going to say something you'll regret.
Oh, come on, Granny. What can I possibly say that'll make things worse than they already are? Demanded Calvin. I mean, look at old Mr. Norris up there. Both of us are... Oh, hello, miss. Didn't know we had anyone else here. He had just seen Melinda. Hi, she said. She had the feeling that she'd walked in on an old argument the two had had many times, and that did not concern her. Her fear and anger were forgotten for the moment. Calvin had been talking to Granny like a sullen kid, but something about what they were saying seemed wrong.
Can I help you, Melinda?
Asked Granny Royce.
Is there something wrong with your room?
That brought her back.
No, she said. The room is fine, but... Nothing else is. I mean, what on earth do you even have a roadhouse out here where it seems like no one ever stops? Why are most of the rooms full, even though mine's the only car out there? Why did I hear you talking to Mr. Norris like he was a dog, and why would you want to make sure I didn't see him?
She got no further before Calvin cut her off. Good Lord, she's not even been here at night and she can already see it. Why'd you even let her in, Granny? Why don't you just bolt the door? Hell, if I could go take down that sign, don't you think I would have by now?
Lord love a duck.
That's something you don't hear many young men say, thought Melinda. She decided to ignore Calvin for the moment, otherwise.
And besides that, there's someone out there. He's the freak who slashed my tires, and he's been out there messing up my car since then, and you can't even call the police? Are you going to tell me you've never had vandals out here before?
There was a long pause in the room. Neither Granny nor Calvin seemed willing to break it. Calvin scratched at his neck. For the first time, Melinda noticed a red slash at his throat, half hidden by his collar. It looked like either a very fresh scar or a slightly healed wound. "Listen, miss, I don't know your name," he finally said.
"Melinda,"
she told him. "Melinda," he repeated. "Melinda, I think you should sit down. I gotta tell you something you might find troubling." Melinda did not like how he said that. She also didn't like the way his tone had switched from sullen child to serious adult. He looked several years her junior, but he was talking to her like he was her uncle or her boss. He swallowed a sip of tea and sighed. Then he looked her straight in the face and said, "The reason I don't have a car out there is that when I got here, no one my age in my line of work would have ever owned a car. Would have seemed like an impossible dream."
"What?
What are you talking about?" she asked hesitantly. "I worked in a textile mill," he said. "The mill was shut down by the time I got here. Most businesses were. So I struck out on my own. A drifter looking for what work I could find. I stopped here. Forever."
"Businesses were shut down. I don't understand," said Melinda.
"We're having a rough time right now, but businesses are mostly staying open."
"Not then they weren't," said Calvin sadly.
"I arrived here in 1929. Melinda blinked. Something had exploded behind her eyes.
"This place was new then," said Granny. "My man and I just opened it. And young Mr. Calvin was a sweet young lad of 16. Offered to take him on as hired help over my husband's objections. Well, my husband was a well-meaning man, but he knew how to pinch a penny. 'Twas a year after I took Calvin in that Mr. Royce died. Calvin and I have been here ever since. Every few years or so, someone joins us."
"Yep," Calvin broke in. "Miss Tilly was first. She was a woman of ill repute who ran here pregnant and scared that the man who'd run her trade up in New York was going to find her and kill her. She and that baby," he broke off, now seeming on the point of tears.
"And then," said Granny, "there was Mr. Standish. He was a traveling minister. He don't travel no more."
"Mr. Norris got here in 69, said Calvin. "His story's probably the worst. He was a... well, he was a bank robber, you see. Carried a pistol. He didn't like learning how long we all been here." He paused, stood, and walked to the kitchen window. "Tried to leave on his own, you see. He ain't the first to try it. That was me, actually. Warned him not to try, but he wouldn't listen. When he got outside, he met him."
"Calvin," hissed Granny. "We don't talk about this."
"She's got to know," said Calvin. "There's no point in her finding out slowly."
"There's still a chance for her," said Granny in a stage whisper. "All she has to do is wait until morning."
"She's not going to wait until morning," said Calvin with some remorse in his voice. "No one ever waits until morning. The fact she came down here is proof enough of that. Besides, what good would that have really done her? Car is useless. We have no phones here. There was no phone when the place was went up. There won't never be a phone here. You know that."
"Okay, everyone stop," Melinda shouted. "That's enough. Now you can't keep me prisoner here, and I have no intention of staying any longer. Only that knife-wielding maniac out there is keeping me from running up the road at this minute. Now I need to know what's really going on here, and I need to know now."
"We've been telling you," Calvin said. "Granny may not want you to know everything, but you need to.
Because you won't be leaving. Oh, and we're not trying to keep you prisoner. I don't even care if you run out that door right now, but you'll never leave this house again afterward. Like hell I won't, yelled Melinda. Listen, child, said Granny, raising from her spot at the table. Listen, please. None of us mean you harm, my dear. Not even Mr. Norris. Or Scandy can do any more, and he knows it. That's why he's up there crying all the time, but we're stuck here, all of us. I hope there was a chance for you to run out in the morning, but Calvin's right. There's no guarantee you'd be safe in the morning anyhow. What the hell? What the hell's wrong with this place? Choked out Melinda. She was beginning to break down. She could feel the tears welling in her eyes. It was about a month after Mr. Royce died, said Calvin, when he came. He was wearing that long black robe and carrying that ridiculous dagger. Saw him when I was trimming the hedges in the back. Told him he needed to get out of here because I didn't like his look. He moved so fast I never even saw it coming. Then he got me. From here, Calvin touched his neck. To here. He touched his lower abdomen on the opposite side of his neck slash. He began to undo his shirt. Melinda almost vomited. Under his shirt was a long, ugly slash that went deep, and it was still seeping blood. She could see bone, muscle, and intestines wriggling within that mangled ruin. I died that night, said Calvin, but then I didn't. Next thing I knew, I was being dragged into the house by Granny, and when I woke up, I nearly scared her to death. She was sure that I was gone. Thing is, I was, but I was awake. I could talk, walk, do anything I could do while alive. Except take any nourishment or enjoyment from food or drink anymore. I still drink tea because it keeps my skin from turning ash gray. Learned that about 50 years ago.
He didn't go away, though,
Granny broke in. I went out to deal with him, carrying my axe. He took my axe, buried it in my back. I won't show you the wound, honey. Calvin should have shown you his either, but no one should ever have to see it. But that's how he works, Melinda, continued Calvin. He's got that knife, but if you try to use a weapon on him, he just moves like he does and takes it from you. You never stand a chance. He'll use whatever weapon you try to take him down with to end you. Mr. Norris learned that the hard way. This is not happening. Melinda was ready to break down. She had to hold it together. She had to get out of here somehow. Nothing about this was right. Nothing about it could be real. It was all a dream. Too much of it didn't make sense. Her father calling her out of the blue. Her leaving to go to him without a second thought. Getting lost so quickly and so irreversibly. No cell service anywhere on the road. This place, everything about it. She was dreaming. That had to be it. But if so, she was going to survive this dream. She turned and ran for the stairs. Her purse was still in her room, but she was going to grab it and go. She'd had enough. Protesting voices began babbling behind her, but she cared not one whit. Mr. Norris was waiting at the top of the stairs. Contrary to Granny Royce's description of him, he was not old at all, no more than about 40. But she saw instantly what she meant by not at all there. The top half of Mr. Norris's head looked normal, like a reasonably attractive man with dark hair peppered with gray here and there. His eyes, a clear green, were moist with fresh tears. The lower half of his face was a ruin of bone fragments, shredded muscle and blood. So much blood. His left side was similarly destroyed. His arm hung on with a few hanging strings of muscle. His hip was just as much of a mess of a bone as blood as his face was. He kept his one good hand on the banister as he shuffled toward her. Behind him stood a young woman in a bra and a pair of panties. Her stomach was cut open, and looking out of the wound with bright, intelligent eyes was the mangled remains of a baby. Melinda turned and bolted from the front door. Her hand had just closed around the knob when Calvin rushed up to her, placing his freezing cold hands over hers. "They're not gonna hurt you," he said quickly, "but he will. If you step out for so much as a moment, he will kill you and it'll hurt. And it'll keep on hurting. Forever. After a while, you learn to function with the pain, but it never goes away. Sobbing, she asked the question she'd been afraid to ask since coming here. Who is he?
We don't know,
said Granny from behind Calvin.
He just came here and he won't go away. He likes to watch us and do things to incite us to come out again. As soon as someone does, he hurts them more, but no matter how many times he kills us, we don't die. Believe me when I say I wish we all could.
Melinda had enough of this. She pushed Calvin away and threw open the door. He was standing on the porch. The knife was held out in front of him just at face level. Melinda ran into him at a rush, the knife puncturing her right eye, its tip sliding on through out to the other side. She just managed to see the grinning, pure white face of her killer before everything went black. A few hours later, the house erupted with screams from upstairs as Melinda awoke to a world of pain, the like of which she had never known. I stood still for a moment, awestruck. The pictures didn't do it justice. It was a large but quaint home located on a secluded island near Cape Cod. A small piece of land void of life, only the cottage and a lighthouse visible across the water. Verified as an Airbnb Plus rental, 1 week's rent came to be a little over $3,000. The price was steep, but completely worth it. This would be the best place to clear my head and finish writing my novel. I happily trotted across the stone walkway to the front door and grabbed the knob, ready to map out the rest of my book. It'd be my second release. My publisher had been breathing down my neck for months, constantly asking for updates. Now, I had the perfect environment to complete it. Upon entering the door, I was caught off guard. Hello? I nearly jumped out of my skin. There was a man inside. Late 50s, average build, gray mustache. It took me a moment to match the face to the one on his superhost profile. It was Garrett, the owner of the property. Sorry, Garrett. He startled me. I didn't expect anyone to be here. He smiled. I greet all my guests. You people are my livelihood, after all. Please, come in. We have some important matters to discuss. I joined him in the living room. We sat in armchairs opposite side of a long coffee table. Garrett simply continued to smile. So, what did you want to discuss? I asked. He pulled a folded sheet of paper out from his jacket and slid it across the coffee table. It stopped in front of me. I picked it up for a closer look. The edges were worn, and it felt almost canvas-like between my fingers. I began unfolding, but Garrett stopped me. Don't. You'll have plenty of time for that later. Just listen. I looked up at him, confused, but compliant. This house has been in my family for generations. Staying here can be a rewarding experience, but it can also be a dreadful one if you're not careful. Come on, Garrett. Don't tell me this place is haunted. I was the only one smiling now. Garrett looked at me thoroughly unamused. My smile vanished, and I gestured for him to continue. On that sheet of paper are some rules. You must follow every last one of them. There are no exceptions. So long as you do this, your vacation will be a pleasant one. With that, Garrett stood up from the chair and walked to the front door. He turned to me on his way out and offered a final sentiment before leaving. Follow the rules, Jack. If you don't, you're in for a bumpy ride. When he left, I unfolded the list, expecting to see a reiteration of his, say, requirements. No pets, no modifications, clean up after yourself, that sort of thing. This was not the case.
On the paper was a set of rules that only served to bookend our strange encounter with further confusion. Number 1. No lights on past 11:25 p.m. Number 2. Do not answer your phone. Callers cannot be trusted. Number 3. Only 2 people are permitted inside. Hank Penston and Jessica Covenwood. Ask for last names. Number 4. Do not exit the house after midnight until sunrise. Number 5. If your room changes location, close the door and try again. Only leave when connection has been reestablished. Number 6. The voices are harmless. Don't converse with them. Number 7. Never lock the doors. Number 8. If you have any trouble, call Jessica Covenwood at this number. This is the only phone call you can trust. This lifeline may only be used once during your rental period. At the bottom of the page was a final note. I will come to collect you, but only when the rental period is over. Not a moment sooner. There's no leaving until then. I sat there, mulling over the list. It all became clear. Garrett was a lunatic. Either that, or this was a poor attempt at humor. Either way, I brushed off our meeting and the list of rules altogether, placing the paper on the coffee table where it stayed for the rest of the night. A majority of the first night was peaceful. Of my novel's final 6 chapters that needed completing, I was able to stay up and finish 2 of them, first drafts at least. There was still a lot left to do. My final days on the island would have to be spent proofreading the entire manuscript and filling cracks in the narrative before sending it to my editor. Still, 2 chapters was not a bad night's work, all things considered. After patting myself on the back for a job well done, I looked at my phone. It was 12:18 a.m. My lips spread into a slight smile as I looked at the desk light wavering in and out of life. It's past 11:25, Garrett. Was this why I needed to turn off the lights, so they wouldn't flicker? I chuckled to myself as another rule came to mind. Number 4, if I remember correctly. Do not exit the house after midnight. I continued to laugh to myself as I ventured downstairs, opened the front door, and stepped out into the night. The view was brilliant. A blanket of stars covering the cape, only broken up by the gorgeous lighthouse jutting upward, practically cutting a hole in the night sky. It was a breathtaking sight, well worth the partial advance for my book. What's the reasoning behind this rule, Garrett? You didn't want me to enjoy the view? I turned and stepped back into the house. I then locked the door. Oops, that's another rule broken. Hope the house doesn't chastise me. With that, I traveled upstairs to the bedroom and fell into a blissful sleep the moment my body met the sheets. But my slumber would not last. 3:27 a.m. I awoke to a thunderous banging at the front door. In a groggy slur of motion, my leg just barely managed to pull the rest of my body out of bed. Practically sleepwalking, I eventually made my way downstairs and opened the door. Outside, there were no longer any stars. The light was replaced with a thick fog rolling over the ocean. The water and air were still, frozen in place. There was no one there but me. I closed the door and went back to bed, certain that the sounds I heard were remnants of a dream overlapping with waking life. My body fell into the bed, and sleep took hold once more. 4:42 a.m. I woke again, ripped from a dream state where I was turning in my novel to the publishing house. For whatever reason, in this dream, Garrett was my boss. He held the manuscript to my face and flipped the pages, revealing a lack of ink. There's nothing here, Jack. All that time and nothing to show for. He continued to flip through before stopping somewhere in the middle. Unlike the other pages, this one had text. The words were familiar, but they weren't written by me. Garrett's rules painted the page, the pitch-black ink slowly dripping from the paper. His form soon followed, melting onto the floor below. You should have followed the rules, Jack. That's when I sprung to life, my heart pounding as I sat up in bed. The sound of pages turning rang in my ears, but it hadn't leaked over from my nightmare. Over on the desk, my manuscript, its paper wildly flapping about. My heart nearly sank before I noticed a chill in the room. I left the window open. It was just the wind. Relieved, I shut the window and went back to sleep. 5:19 a.m. No sound woke me this time. Instead, it was nature calling, beckoning me to take a late-night trip to the bathroom. Unfortunately for me, this would not be an easy task. Upon opening the bedroom door, I was greeted by a deeply unsettling sight. It was a hallway. Not the hallway that should be there, mind you. An entirely different hallway. Noticeably different. It was narrow, almost too thin for a person to walk through. It was long, very long, seemingly longer than the building itself. Lining the sides was a plethora of doors, more doors than I knew the house would have. It was, by all means, unexplainable. I rubbed my eyes to test their acuity. The hallway was still there. I wondered for a moment if I was dreaming, but quickly discarded the notion, certain that I could tell the difference between what was real and what wasn't. But if not a dream, then what? With an air of hesitance about me, my feet pattered into the narrow void. I tried each door along the way, but they were all locked. Halfway in, a harrowing sound cut through the air. I turned my head to see that the bedroom door had shut itself. Running back and turning the knob was futile. It wouldn't budge. Without a whole lot of options, I continued down the hall. At the end was a final door, different than the rest. Affixed to it was a plaque with a designation, like one you might see in a hotel. According to the text, it was the room 371. The knob offered no resistance as I turned it and gently pushed the door open. There were no lights inside. Still, I could make out something standing in the center of the room facing me. It was a shadowy figure, slightly darker than the blackness around it. A vague glow outlined its form. It was tall, taller than any man. I had the inclination to close the door and turn back, but fear kept me anchored in place. My breathing became erratic, and my heart rate soared to new heights as it took a step toward me. In a flash, it lunged to my position. Everything went black. My eyes opened to sunlight in the room. I was back in bed. This was strange. Every bone in my body told me it wasn't a dream, but rational thinking dictated otherwise. I had no choice but to entertain the idea that I was having vivid night terrors in the face of a fast-approaching publishing deadline. The sooner I finished the book, I thought, the sooner they would vanish. Though it didn't sit well with me, it was the only explanation I had. My phone buzzed on the bedside table. I knew who it was, but with my deadline on the horizon, I couldn't afford the distraction. When the buzzing ceased, I crawled out of bed and started the day. My first few hours awake were productive. I was able to write over half of the next chapter and tweak some of the finer details throughout the rest of the book. My progress was, however, impeded by a knock at the front door. Unlike the night previous, there was someone out there. A man. "Can I help you?" I asked, confused. "I was hoping I could help you, actually. Name's Hank. I'm a locksmith from the mainland. Garrett sent me to check the locks on all the doors." I pondered for a moment and then grabbed the list of rules from the coffee table. I looked it over before meeting Hank back at the door. Well, looks like you're on the list. Splendid. May I come in, then? An unnaturally wide smile danced across his cheeks. Yeah, sure, come in. Hank walked past the threshold and sighed. There was a long moment of silence before he spoke again. What a lovely place. Can't wait to sink my teeth in and get to work. He then sauntered off upstairs. I sat down on the couch and continued writing, hoping my creative breakthrough hadn't subsided. An hour passed, and then another. I was able to finish up some more work, but something kept scratching at the back of my mind. I knew locksmithing wasn't the loudest job out there, but I expected to hear at least some sort of tinkering coming from upstairs. The distant sound of keys scraping against the locks in her chambers, but no. There was only silence. I then wondered why Hank was there to begin with. This was far from a typical rental experience, especially one on a secluded island. I skimmed the list again. Two things stood out. Rule number 7, never lock the doors. Even if Garrett was deranged, it was clear he didn't want the doors locked, so why then would he send a locksmith? Who could or would be breaking in out here anyway? The second thing that jumped out at me was at the end of rule number 3. Ask for last names. Something wasn't adding up, but I intended to get to the bottom of it. Hank! I yelled out, hoping to get his attention. There was no answer. Hank, can you please come down here? No response. Only silence. This was my cue to investigate. To my dismay, the second floor was completely vacant. I scoured every room, every nook and cranny the house had to offer, to no avail. Hank was nowhere to be found. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. How could a person just up and vanish like that? I returned to the first floor. Hank was there, sitting on the couch, looking over my manuscript. There was no way he could have snuck by me. Say, this is pretty good. I wonder how it's going to play out. Tell me out here, Jack. Is there a happy ending, or does this man succumb to his own demons? I stood frozen at the bottom of the stairs. Hank, I asked, what's your last name? A grin formed beneath his nose. Redden? Name's Hank Redden. Why do you ask? I looked down at the list in my hand. Penston. His name was supposed to be Hank Penston. No reason, just curious. Hey, do you mind tossing me my phone? Hank looked down at my phone on the coffee table. A few moments passed before he grabbed it and looked over at me. He stared for a long time, almost as if calculating the distance, and then finally threw it over. I caught it and ran back for the front door. Thanks. I'll be right back. I sprinted to the end of the island, unsure of who or what was inside of the house. It was becoming ever apparent that Garrett might not be so crazy after all. Something truly strange was afoot, and I wanted no part of it. At first, I called the ferry station. No answer. And then Garrett. Still, no answer. Before I could try another number, my ex-wife called. I've been ignoring her calls for weeks. Charlotte, thank God. I'm at an Airbnb off the Cape. I need you to... She interjected. Leslie's dead, Jack. My blood ran cold. was said with the same tone and resentment as it was 2 years before. All at once, the floodgates opened, and the slew of memories poured in, ones I had tried desperately to repress. Leslie was our daughter, before Charlotte and I divorced. She was struck by a car on her way home from school. Charlotte was at work, and I was supposed to pick Leslie up, but I was too wrapped up in my first novel. I forgot all about her, my own daughter. She walked a good mile before the collision. I never forgave myself. Neither did Charlotte. Charlotte, why are you saying this? Tears rolled down my face. She's dead, Jack. It's your fault. My baby is dead, all because of you. Her voice became louder and less distinct until I could barely recognize the cadence, an inhuman growl. You're to blame, Jack. You belong where you are. I hope you rot in that house. I looked down at the list, now stained with the steady stream of droplets dripping from my cheek. And that's when I remembered rule number 2. Do not answer your phone. Callers cannot be trusted. As much as it pained me, I hung up on her. It wasn't real. But it sure as hell felt like it was. I wiped away my tears and looked at the last rule. Braving the fierce currents of the ocean likely wouldn't end well. The shore nearly 16 miles away. So Jessica was my only hope. The only phone call you can trust, according to Garrett. I dialed the number and waited. After 2 tones, my ear was met with a female voice. You broke a rule, didn't you? A few, actually, give or take. She let out a sigh. Did you let anyone in? Yes. Hank. Hank Penston? No. Hank Redden. There was another disappointed sigh. Okay, listen carefully. I want you to go to the back of the house, but act natural. No sudden moves or conspicuous behavior. Any slight change in your attitude could set him off. Walk slow and be cautious. Okay. I did as instructed. On my way around the house, I looked through the window. Hank was no longer in the living room, and there was a slight spike in my adrenaline, but I held my composure. Until turning the corner, that is. Standing at the back of the house, waiting for me, was Hank. Hey there, Jack. What are you up to? Jessica chimed in. Stay calm and repeat what I say verbatim. Hank, I have Garrett on the phone. He wants to know if you can check the lock on the front door. He says it's been sticking lately. Hank bore a stoic expression for a few moments and then spoke. That darn thing. I'll see what I can do. He walked past me and went to the front of the house. I was officially rattled. Jessica's voice broke the tension. About 12 yards from the house is an electrical box. Do you see it? I surveyed the area and noticed the box. It was embedded in a tree stump of all places. One that stuck out of the ground at an awkward angle. Yeah, I see it. Good. Open the hatch. There's a lever there. I want you to pull it down and then wait exactly 10 seconds, after which you will place it back in its original position and close the hatch. I was confused. How is this going to help exactly? There was a third sigh of frustration. That is the master switch. When you pull the lever, it will deactivate all energy on the island. When you reset the lever, the house will reconstitute. This will wipe the slate clean. I didn't understand how it all worked, but I had heard enough to warrant an obvious follow-up question. Couldn't I just leave it off? There was no sigh this time, just anger. No. The island is far worse when the energies are at bay. 10 seconds is all you're allowed. At this point, I saw Hank walking alongside the house.
I fixed that lock for you, Jack.
Jessica must have heard because her voice adopted a tone of urgency.
Pull the lever now.
I did as she said and began counting. Hank continued to walk toward me, his form phasing in and out like a bad television signal.
Jack, where are you going? I need a hand?
His pace grew faster until his walk became a run. My heart was pounding. Just as he was closing in, the 10 seconds were up, and I forced the lever back. Hank vanished completely, and the stump receded into the earth below. I fell back into the ground in relief.
Jessica, we did it.
Click. Clearly, she wasn't as pleased with the victory as I was. I was fine. I was just thankful to be alive. Once inside the house, I lay down in bed and held the list to my face, scrutinizing every last detail. I was determined to not break another rule for the rest of my stay. That night was peaceful. I made sure all the doors were unlocked, turned off the lights by 11:25, and refused to answer any calls. When I slept, there were no strange dreams. No dreams at all, in fact. It was a truly restful night. Best sleep I had in years. Despite my predicament, I awoke hopeful. Hopeful that I could weather the storm and survive the week. I was even able to write some more in my book. Not much, but enough to jumpstart my creativity. The next night didn't go nearly as well. 2:12 a.m. I'd woken without cause. In an effort to fall back asleep, I shut my eyes and allowed my mind to wander. I thought of my book and the deadline. I thought of my eventual departure from the island. Before long, I thought of Charlotte and Leslie. The image of our once happy family would forever be seared in my broken heart. I felt my eyes begin to water, but something interrupted the sadness. A sound. Footsteps. My eyes opened and I sprang to life, sitting upright in bed. Footsteps stopped just outside the room. With a great deal of apprehension, I got out of bed, took a deep breath, and tiptoed to the door. When I turned the knob and opened it, I found myself at the entrance of the house. With Rule 5 in mind, I shut the door and opened it again. I was now at the living room. Next was the bathroom, and then a hallway, a familiar hallway. Off in the distance, I heard the click of room 371's door. A tall shadow stepped out. The hall began to shrink. The figure closed the gap between us in a matter of seconds. Luckily, my will to live outweighed the fear that held me in place. I managed to shut the door just in time to prevent my demise. When I opened it again, the room was back where it was supposed to be. 3:47 a.m. Just as I was finally drifting back to sleep, the voices started. Hey, Jack, enjoying your stay? Though frightened, Rule 6 came to mind and I followed it. The voices were harmless, and I was not to converse with them. What's wrong, Jack? Hung up on Garrett's rules? That's no fun. I closed my eyes as the voice grew louder and hid beneath the covers. Don't hide, Jack. We won't hurt you. Honest. Footsteps were back. Walking outside the room, they stopped at the door. He's here now, Jack. I can tell you how to make him go away, but you have to talk to me. The door creaked open and the footsteps recommenced, walking over to the side of the bed. He's leaning over you now. I can make him leave, just say the word. I couldn't give in to the ploy. I had to obey the rules. But then there was a tug on the sheets. My heart nearly stopped.
Wake up, Jack!
I jolted into a sitting position. The room was empty, the door shut. It was a dream. But that didn't explain the hand-shaped impression on the edge of the bed. No matter the culprit, I would endure the torment. It was only a week. You could get through this, Jack. Leslie's face flashed in my mind and forced an unexpected tear out. You've been through so much worse. The next few nights came and went without issue. There were some dicey moments, but I learned to handle the odd voice here and there and the room moving every now and again. I ignored knocks at the front door altogether, avoiding any and all potential repeats of the Hank incident. Night 6, however, was by far the worst. Some things never change. Dark clouds loomed over the ocean as waves crashed into the island. Just like the night Leslie was killed, I became deeply engrossed in my writing, to the point that nothing in the world could have pulled me away. Even after everything that had happened in the house, I was somehow able to finish the book. Maybe the shock to my system inspired me. My fear had transformed into focus, granting me greater mental clarity. When all was said and done, the editing complete, there was a horrible revelation. According to my phone, it was 11:24 p.m. My heart sank to the depths of my soul as I raced across the house, shutting lights off, knocking over furniture and decorations in the process. When I came back to the bedroom to turn off the final light at the desk, I glanced at my phone once more. The readout is now etched into my memory. 11:26 p.m. I clicked off the light, praying that my phone's readout was somehow wrong and that I still had time. 11:27 p.m. The bedroom door slammed itself shut behind me. I jostled the knob and pushed my weight against it, but it remained unmoved. A swirling black vortex of smoke was expelled from beneath the bed. It covered the floor in an instant and began rising to fill the rest of the room. I had no intention of waiting to see what would happen to me in the darkness, so I flung myself at the window and shattered the glass, landing on my back in a bed of shrubbery below. The impact knocked the wind out of me. Shortly thereafter, I passed out. 11:38 p.m. I dreamt. I know it was a dream, but not the house's doing because it was one I'd had many times before. The setting, my daughter's school. The bell rang, and a stampede of children rushed out into the world, excited to leave for the day and see their parents. The last person out was Leslie, left to her own devices.
Daddy, where are you?
Her eyes darted back and forth. I tried to call out to her, but much like the day in question, I wasn't there. In the dream, I was only an observer, forced to watch as the horror unfolded before me. Leslie waited for 15 long minutes before heading off in the direction of our home. I bore witness to her trek, a poor girl alone in the cold. And then it happened. Dream tears flooded my view as a car swerved and the heart-wrenching scream of that beautiful young girl rang out through the winter air. p.m. I woke up on the ground, covered in tears, broken glass. The ocean waves crashed against the walls of the house. There was no time to waste. Without my phone, I didn't know exactly what time it was, but it had to be close to midnight. Another broken rule would only make matters worse. I raced to the front door, opened it, and swiftly shut it behind me, somewhat thankful to be back in the house, but also somewhat terrified. The coming moments would echo the latter emotion, adding to my woes. 12:05 a.m. I was able to open the bedroom door and retrieve my phone. Luckily, the smoke had vanished. Upon venturing back down to the living room, I was shattered, just like the glass on the ground outside. There, sitting on the couch where Hank had sat before, was Leslie. My Leslie. I reached the bottom step and nearly fell to my knees, almost forgetting to breathe in the process. She was the same. Exactly the same. Every feature identical to the day I last saw her. How was this possible? Hi, Daddy. Her voice pulled a wave of emotion out of me, stronger than anything I'd ever felt before. Was it really her? Was this really my precious Leslie brought back to life? Surely this wasn't the house's doing, was it? Sweetheart, is that you? Is that really you? She looked over at me with innocent eyes. Yes, Daddy, it's me. I ran over to her. I took her in my arms, my face now drenched in an ocean of tears. Oh, Leslie, sweetheart, I missed you so much. I pulled away to get a better look at her. That's when I saw it. For an instant, in between blinks, her eyes were solid pools of black. This was not my Leslie. I backed away at once. What's wrong, Daddy? I continued to retreat to the stairs. You're not real. This isn't real. We buried you. Her next words stopped me in my tracks. No, Daddy. You buried me. Her eyes locked with mine as I cried. You killed me. You're the reason I'm dead. I took a panicked breath before responding. You're right. I was a terrible father, and I deserve every moment of torture this house puts me through. If I ever get out of here, I'm going to visit your grave for the first time and tell you how sorry I am, how much I missed you over the years. Not a day goes by that the guilt doesn't eat me up inside. I swallowed a lump in my throat and wiped away the tears as she looked at me. But you're not her. I ran up those stairs as fast as I could. Leslie's piercing screams echoed through the house, followed by the sound of every window breaking in reaction to the pitch. Once in the bedroom, I closed the door behind me and slid down into a sitting position on the floor against it, utterly defeated and emotionally drained. I pulled out my phone and dialed Jessica's number. After two tones, she picked up. What is it this time? Don't tell me you broke another rule. I think I'm going to die tonight, Jessica. Her perturbed tone vanished, replaced with concern. Jack, what did you do? What's going on over there? I can't fight it anymore. It's too much. As much as I wanted to live, I could feel myself getting up. I didn't even know why I called her. She couldn't help. The lever was gone and it was past midnight. The storm outside was destroying the house. Soon I would be swept out to sea, never to be heard from again. Hold on, Jack. I'll be there soon. Click. She wasn't coming. Even if the fairies ran that late, they wouldn't dare operate in a storm this violent. The end was near, and I could feel it. 1:13 a.m. After a long while of wallowing in self-pity, there was a knock at the door. Jessica? No, it couldn't be. I cautiously exited the bedroom and slowly descended the staircase into the living room below. Storm raged outside, a gust of wind howling through the house. In reaching the bottom step, I noticed that the coast was clear. Leslie's ghost was nowhere in sight. As quickly as I could, without drawing any unwanted attention to myself, I pattered over to the door and opened it. Behind it was a beautiful woman in her 30s, black hair, peach skin, and a tasteful spattering of freckles on either side of her nose. "Jessica?" I asked. "Who else would it be?" Her voice and sassy attitude answered my question in spades. I stepped aside and she barged in, clearly upset. I closed the door behind her, careful not to lock it and risk breaking another rule. I was less scared of the supernatural consequences than I was of Jessica's fury. "You really have me worried, Jack. What did you do anyway?" Before I could answer, a small figure appeared from behind the couch. It was Leslie. Jessica followed my gaze and looked across the room. "Jack, who is that?" "It's my daughter." "I didn't know she was here with you." "You don't understand. My daughter's been dead for 2 years. Jessica backed up to the door where I was still standing. "Oh, I see." Just as before, Leslie let out an awful shriek that rang through the house. It was louder than before, much louder. Jessica turned to me, our hands cupping our ears.
"Jack, we need to get out of here. Follow me."
We raced past Leslie and up the stairs to the bedroom.
"Okay, Jack, let's get going."
She shut the door and opened it. She continued this routine, revealing the many rooms of the house. At one point, it opened up to the living room. Jessica quickly slammed it shut before Leslie could make her way in to get us. Finally, it opened up into the hallway. Yes, that hallway. Jessica grabbed my wrist. "Come on. Let's go." I yanked my arm back in refusal. "Are you insane? I've been there and I don't plan on going back. Have you seen room 371? Jessica let out one of her signature sighs. "Yes, I know all about it. So long as we get to where we're going before the shadow notices, we'll be fine. Now come on. We don't have a lot of time here." I reluctantly respected her wishes. I wasn't keen on facing that ominous stretch of hall again, but Jessica's advice hadn't failed me yet. Besides, I was ready to die just an hour ago. Whatever fate would befall me in there couldn't be any worse than seeing my dead daughter resurrected. "Okay, Jessica. I'm ready." 1:36 a.m. Matching each other's pace, step for step, we disappeared into the dark hallway, the bedroom door closing behind us. I whispered so as to not wake the beast. "Where are we going anyway? None of the doors down here open." Without hesitation, she answered. "One does." It took a moment for it to sink in. "No, Jessica, are you serious? I can't go in that room. It lives in there." She turned to me and put her hands on either side of my face. She stared into my eyes with a look of pure kindness. I was taken aback by the unexpected intimacy. "Jack, you need to calm down. Just trust me. We're going to be fine, I promise." As far as explanations go, that was pretty vague, but it was still reassuring. I can't explain it, but I was compelled to believe her. There was something about Jessica I really liked, a warmth that radiated around her, a contagious, soothing force. We continued down the hall, and I didn't bring up my reservations again. 1:42 a.m. We reached the door. This was it. The moment of truth. I was about to open it when Jessica pulled my hand back. In order for this to work, you need to knock 3 times. No more, no less. I nodded in agreement. I raised my hand to the wood and knocked precisely 3 times. A deep anxiety racked my nerves as the anticipation grew. After a few moments, the door was pulled open, revealing the shadowy figure within. I stepped away and motioned for us to enter. I looked over to Jessica for approval. She nodded and followed me in. The entity softly closed the door behind us, then walked over to where we stood and changed. Its dark form turned to light, illuminating the rest of the room. It was the bedroom, only it wasn't exactly the same. Something was amiss. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. It just felt different. The bright figure then shrunk down to a glowing orb and drifted away, phasing through one of the walls, leaving us by ourselves. Moonlight shone through the window. The glass wasn't broken anymore. There was no storm outside. Everything was pristine. Jessica, what just happened? This is the house's safe space. A fail-safe when too many rules are broken. She could tell I wasn't following. It's a copy of the bedroom, just before things went south. A moment suspended in time that we can stay in for a while. At dawn, everything will revert to normal. Why didn't you tell me about it before? Honestly, it's a risky move. The shadow is a fickle being. When you enter room 371, there's only a 50% chance he'll accept your entrance. Otherwise, you're doomed. I couldn't believe it. You're telling me we could have died? You risked our lives on a 50% chance. She came over and placed her hands on my face again. Jack, we're safe. There's no need to be angry. Just relax. We would have died anyway at the hands of the house. This was our only option. She was right. Honestly, I was happy she was there. Without her, I would have been a goner. 3:17 a.m. Jessica spent some time going over my manuscript. I filled in some of the blanks so she could skip the more fatty sections and finish before bed. Jack, this is beautiful. I wasn't so sure. Maybe I put too much of myself in it. Maybe the blood I poured onto the pages covered up the meaning. Who in their right mind would want to swim through my despair to reach a story even I wasn't sure I believed in? It's about you, isn't it, Jack? This is your life from the moment your daughter died to now. I felt myself unraveling. I'm tired, Jessica. I think I'm going to call tonight. I offered her a half smile, waltzed over to the bed, and laid down. To my surprise, she lay down with me and placed her head on my chest. It's okay, Jack. I've never lost a child, so I can't imagine the kind of things you're dealing with. I do know that things will never be the same. That doesn't mean you have to give up. What would your daughter have wanted? There was no fighting the tears any longer. You don't understand, Jessica. I'm responsible. She was waiting for me when it happened. I was her father, and I wasn't there for her when she needed me. Jessica didn't respond. I sobbed until there was nothing left in me. When the moment passed, I asked her a question. Why do these things happen here? Honestly, I don't really know. We turned to each other. Her warmth reared its head again, inviting me to come to it. Our lips met, and with it an intense feeling was born, like nothing I'd ever felt. A somber, quiet energy filled the air and coated the room. In a turn of events I will never fully fathom, Jessica and I made love. AM. Jessica fell asleep in my arms. I stayed awake, content for the first time in years. Then a familiar, disembodied voice burrowed into my ear and poisoned my mind. What you're feeling isn't real. By this point, I was all too familiar with the voice and their antics. I ignored its statement. She does this to every tenant. She's a seductress. I was tempted to reply, but conversing was forbidden. I couldn't afford a broken rule this close to the finish line. Only two people are allowed in, Jack. Two. It's a simple rule. What did that have to do with anything? What was the voice up to? Jessica was one of the two. Despite my unrest, I continued to bite my tongue. Always ask for last names. There was a moment of pause before the realization washed over me. I gasped. The rule had indeed been broken. I jumped and backed to the corner of the room. Jessica was standing next to the bed. I hadn't even seen her get up. Jack, you okay? My breathing became labored. It was hard to construct my query in a normal fashion. Jessica, are you really you? What's this? What's your last name? The light left her face, her eyes, now empty, cut right through me. I slid to the floor. A long period of silence passed before anything changed. Before she changed. 5:51 a.m. Jessica's face widened. Her eyes became large, as if physically engorged with bloodlust. She lunged at me. I dodged the attack and hit the door hard. I reached for the knob, but it wouldn't turn. Jessica's new form spoke, a gurgling, metallic sound that ricocheted off the walls. It looks like you're stuck with me, Jack. She lunged again. I slid under the bed to escape her reach. Her feet paced around its perimeter, like a predator circling its prey. It was a matter of time now. I closed my eyes and thought of Charlotte, Leslie playing in the snow. Lastly, I saw them together. This would be my final thought as death approached. As beautiful a thought as one could have before dying. At least now I could be with her again. A pained outcry from Jessica broke my concentration. The light in the room had changed. I rolled out from underneath the bed and saw her writhing in the corner. The sun was coming up over the horizon outside. This was my chance. I raced over to Jessica and clenched her neck. She struggled, but was too weak to break free. I forced her against the window. Her skin melted, dripping like candle wax to the floor. Her hair burned to a crisp. I looked to her eyes for even a shred of humanity, something that might convince me to spare her for all she had meant to me. There was none. Only malice. In that moment, I sincerely wished that she had been real. Goodbye, Jessica. With as much force as I could muster, I pushed her through the window. Her form disintegrated before it could reach the ground. The wind carried her ashes away into the endless expanse of the ocean. She was no more. The house was still. Hours passed. As my rental period came to a close, I sat in the living room and reflected on the events of the week. In a weird way, I'd come to terms with Leslie's death. The guilt would always be there, but I felt I could move on now, free of the restraints that once bound me. Knock, knock. I opened the door and let Garrett in. Your ferry awaits. I nodded and gathered my things. I was anxious to leave, but felt the need to ask him something first. Garrett, what is this place? He smirked. Many words come to mind. Anomaly, portal, impossibility. I personally think it's a mirror, showing us ourselves in a way we never thought possible. A place where our past, present, intersect. Perhaps the right word for it is closure. I smiled. You might be onto something, Garrett. Splendid. Does that mean you'll leave me a good review? I chuckled. You know what? I'll do it right now. I opened the app and clicked through the listing. A bit of information caught my eye as I scrolled. Checkout time. 12 p.m. I looked up at the readout at the top of my phone's display. It turned from 11:59 to 12 as I watched. I let someone in before time was up, meaning a rule had been broken. The note at the end of the list came to mind as the dread set in. I'll come to collect you, but only when your rental period is over. Not a moment sooner. That wasn't Garrett. I looked up to see him standing directly in front of me. Something wrong, Jack? I dropped my things and ran out to the dock as fast as I could. The ferry had just arrived, the real Garrett aboard, motioning for me to hurry. After boarding, I turned back and looked at the house one last time. A silhouette stood at the window, waving goodbye.